Hello, I'm your host, Inman Narowin, and this is Strangers in a Tangled Wilderness, a monthly podcast of anarchic literature, where we take our monthly featured zine and turn it into an audio feature and interview the author. You can get a copy of the monthly zine by signing up for our Patreon at patreon.com/strangersinatangledwilderness, or you can read along for free at tangledwilderness.org. This month we have With the Dolphins, a short story by Bill Stickers, about the spirit of adventure on the high seas, the false promises of AI, and the inescapability of worker exploitation in late-stage capitalism, and how solidarity, in all its many forms, can effectively fight on. The word of the month is about the Queen of Rot. Sort of. And as always, our feature is read by the wonderful Bee Flowers. We hope you enjoy.
With the Dolphins, written by Bill Stickers and narrated by Bee Flowers. Bill Stickers is a writer and wilderness paramedic in the Rockies who believes everything to know about them can be found in their art. I applied for the job on a whim, sick of my life in Wilmington, sick of the Motel 5 and its handsy manager, Jeff. I was sick of an apartment that smelled like the last tenant's cigarettes, sick of my own aspirations to be a nursing assistant who wiped asses and changed sheets, and realizing that if I didn't make some kind of drastic change right now, freshly single, just starting to slide down the wrong half of my 30s, then I never would. So I got a little plastic-covered cardboard box of wine from the gas station and sat down to take an inventory of my life. I found a resume template online and pasted the highlights of my so far unremarkable career into it, then sent it off. Once I submitted it, I felt a sense of relief, like shipping off a Christmas gift in time. The next day, I went back to the Motel 5 and ducked Jeff in the morning, retrieving my little cart and setting out turning over the rooms, marking the laminated map with a dry erase marker as I finished each one. I took the garbage out to the dumpster, wiped surfaces, vacuumed floors, took the sheets to the laundry, and all the while I thought about what it might be like to live at sea. I had been on boats, sure. My Uncle Ron had owned a party barge, but had taken us kids fishing out once or twice, but I'd never spent the night on a boat. I tried to imagine what it would be like to be rocked to sleep by the waves, to feel the cool breeze sweep off the water while I leaned on the rail. Maybe I'd see dolphins or a pod of whales. I had owned one of those Lisa Frank folders when I was a kid, hot pink with the smiling dolphins leaping out of the water on the front cover. I remember our science teacher, Mrs. Borland, telling us that dolphins were smart, that they had their own language and spoke to one another. I imagined that the dolphins on my folder were friends, and they liked to swim around eating fish and talking about dolphin boys. At lunch, I went out to my car to cry and eat leftovers like I always did, and finally opened my phone for the first time, sitting in the passenger seat with my sad little plastic container of cabbage and rice. I'd missed a call from New York City, but they'd left a voicemail. It was a recruiter with Otto Klein calling to schedule an interview. I wolfed down my lunch, my mind racing with what I was going to say, and when I'd finished, I called him back. Otto Klein Resources, this is Bill. Hi, Bill, this is Katrina Johnson calling back. Katrina, yes, fantastic. When can we schedule you for an interview? Well, I'm not sure how far of a drive. We'll do this over teleconference, if that's okay. Do you have a computer? He asked, leaning subtly on have enough that I felt he was being just a touch condescending, while probably imagining he did just the opposite. I do. Great. How about tonight? Tonight, Jesus. Okay, I said. Great. 7 work for you. Barely. That was just enough time to get home and throw on a fresh outfit, but I figured I could do it. No, I decided in that moment I would do it. Fuck Jeff. I'd fake sick or just leave if I had to. This was my life, and I was going to take the wheel. 7 works great. See you then. And with that, the line went dead. My chest swelled with a sense of triumph as I marched back through the service entrance, and for the rest of the day I was distracted by my maybe premature sense of victory. I had taken the first big step. Long days spent in monotonous toil were soon to be in the rearview mirror. I was going to sail the high seas on a ship the likes of which the world had never seen. I would endure danger, learn to grapple with crisis, and forge new bonds of friendship and camaraderie, and finally experience capital A adventure. You know, capital A adventure, battling the elements, forging a path into the unknown, boldly going, all that shit. I wanted to slip the surly bonds of boredom and television and my shitty little apartment and Jeff and all the other trappings of a predictable life in a comfortable, sad misery. I wanted to be free. So I floated on a cloud of what I now recognize as delusion for the remainder of my shift, folding towels and cleaning glasses and dusting television sets, as I thought about how I might apply a little polish to the unremarkable details of my work experience to this point, in order to sound like the kind of person who could actually handle a capital A adventure. The fact that this was nearly impossible for a 36-year-old woman who'd lived in the same place and worked the same job for over a decade did little to dampen my sense that this was an inevitability, that in spite of not yet having interviewed, I was destined to be the one for the job. I checked my watch with increasing frequency as 6 o'clock approached, still with 10 more rooms on my list. At 5:59, I stood in the center of room 214 and thought, fuck it. I took off my lanyard and my name tag, put them in the cart's trash can, and I walked out and went home. Fuck it. Fuck the five. Fuck Jeff. Fuck wiping the surfaces and vacuuming the floors. Fuck it. With the advantage of time and distance, I look back now and realize that the interview should have been a red flag to me. It was more a sales pitch than an interview. Bill spent most of the time talking about the exciting, futuristic possibilities of artificial intelligence and how it was the next step in the evolution of the human animal and yada yada yada. In the moment, I was excited that he thought me a good enough prospect to try and talk me into coming aboard. I'd heard of artificial intelligence before, seen it in the movies, basically a computer that talks and thinks like a person, right? I mean, I thought it was interesting, but I wasn't sure why it needed to be on a ship or why that ship needed to sail around the world, but I'd already started swinging the sledgehammer to demolish my life, and I wasn't about to second-guess myself. What I did understand was that artificial intelligence was new and big, and it was in the news, and that people were talking about it. I wanted to be part of it. At the end of the interview, Bill said he'd get back to me as soon as he could and signed off. Staring at the blank screen, I felt like someone was wringing my neck. What was I thinking quitting my job on the spot? What if it took a week? What was I going to do for money? We signed off and I sat in my apartment and just stared at the wall for a while. Whatever happened with the interview, I was proud of myself at least for making a change. That took courage. And I'd never have to see Jeff again. He called me 4 times that night and left 4 voicemails. I deleted all of them without listening. They could keep the change of clothes in my locker. Otto Klein Resources called me the next morning. The morning after that, I was in my car headed to Newark. I had my bag in the trunk, breakfast on the passenger seat, and I was singing along to the radio with the windows down. I felt wild and free in a way I hadn't since I graduated high school, and felt like the world was laid out before me, excited to see how the rest of my life would turn out. I swore a million things in my ecstasy, but most of all, I swore to myself that I would never let it get back to that point, where I felt like a prisoner in my own life. This was, I thought, the beginning of a new me. I was told to report to the docks at 4 o'clock, and I started the 2-hour drive at 8 in the morning. On the way, I stopped and called my landlord to sever my lease. I got my nails and my hair done. I bought some new clothes, a new phone, all on credit. In the line for lunch at one of those burger joints with the menu written in chalk on a sandwich board out front, I realized that I hadn't even asked what I'd be paid. The listing said DOE. The website had said enhanced remuneration, whatever that meant. I calmed my anxiety by remembering that I'd been living on minimum wage, and now I no longer had to pay rent. The ball was rolling. Why slow it down? I arrived at a guardhouse bearing a sign, Consolidated Steel, Newark Shipyard, and gave the security guard my name. He raised the gate for me, and I drove into a massive parking lot in front of two gigantic concrete buildings, one with a banner that said New Employee Orientation. I was met at the door by a woman about my age who looked at my duffel bag with a smirk and then ushered me down a hallway. The afternoon was a blur of faces I'd only ever see one time. The man who confirmed my information, the woman who printed my ID card, another in scrubs who gave me a vaccination for something I'd never heard of. Still rubbing my sore arm, I was directed into an auditorium where I found dozens of other people out of uniform, duffel bags and luggage of every description at their feet. A couple of young people wearing badges that said intern in block letters at the bottom counted heads and passed out pamphlets. Liability waivers, next of kin, direct deposit information, W-4 forms, the usual, as well as a contract that was 20-some sheets of paper, front and back, single-spaced. Just as I was starting to read it, the lights went down. A young man in pressed khakis and a polo shirt bearing the Otto Klein logo, OK, surrounded by the symbol for a molecule the later news reports said is silicon, was spotlighted, already in center stage, and launched without preamble into a presentation on artificial general intelligence and the burdensome nature of narrow-minded regulators trying to limit the horizons of the human future. But OK had a solution. The freedom of the open ocean, of course, beyond the boundaries of any regulator's ability to apply red tape. Using redundant satellite internet connections and a massive bank of raw computing power, our mighty ship, the MSC Rourke, would be a bulwark of human freedom and achievement, and we, its loyal crew, would have our names emblazoned in the annals of history for our tremendous daring. For the remainder of that time, the young man ran through a pretty milquetoast slideshow about nautical terms, port, starboard, bulkhead, all that, and the basic safety procedures of life aboard ship. My ears perked up when he explained that fighting shipboard fires was the duty of every sailor, standing in front of a high-resolution photograph of two people in firefighting gear, spraying water into a hatch through which flames roared. I wondered what kind of training we would get. The presentation ended in applause from all of the interns and members of management stationed at the ends of the rows. After an uncomfortable moment, we newly christened seafarers joined in. I followed the line of people, my fellow sailors now, out through the side door through a long hallway with scaffolding and rails, and out into the dockyard where we finally laid eyes on our vessel, the MSC Rourke. It was ugly. There was no way around it. The flat deck of a barge, with a rectangular flat white superstructure up front, and a larger one in the rear, bookending what looked like an oil refinery, vent towers and support struts and generators and storage tanks in between. I felt a pinhole open up in the balloon of my enthusiasm. In my dreams of being a sailor, only 2 days old, I'd imagined my ship to be, if not sleek, maybe stately, or to at least look like a ship. This looked like a platform for machinery. Where was the bridge? Where were the engines? Men in security uniforms waited on the decks holding rifles and gloved hands, their faces covered by black surgical masks. Were we going to war? Why the anonymity? There were two names on the cabin door, mine and Janelle Smith. I opened the door, bulkhead, I guess, according to the orientation video, and found her sitting on one of the two beds. I smiled, set my bags down, and held out my hand. "I'm Katrina. You must be Janelle. Nice to meet you, Katrina. Some ship, huh?" Yeah, it's, hideous. We shared a laugh. Janelle was from Kansas. I refrained from any Wizard of Oz jokes and had heard about this opportunity from an ad on social media. Just like me, she'd left her job as a hospital custodian, sick of doctors and nurses looking down their nose at her, taken an interview with Bill, then packed up her little life and headed out here for adventure on the open ocean. I woke up with a start in my bunk, nearly falling out of it in a panic. Something was wrong. The room was pitch dark, Janelle still snoring lightly. It took me a moment to sort out just what was going on. We were moving. Wow. I got dressed quietly, using the light of my cell phone screen to find my clothing, put my badge around my neck, and stepped outside. I walked in the direction we were moving, coming around one of the cooling towers for the massive computers on board, and saw that we were being pulled along by two tugboats. I wondered how long they'd stay with us. Were we going to be partners for the whole journey? How much of a journey was it going to be? I leaned my forearms against the rail and looked into the black water below. Just a short fall, really, then swept underneath, knocking against the bottom of the ship, barge, whatever, and then back up, gasping for breath, hoping someone could hear you scream over the sound of the engines. Could you make it to shore from here? Shaking my head to rid my mind of these thoughts, I returned to my cabin, kicked off my slippers, and swiftly found sleep again. The next morning, at an all-hands meeting on the foredeck, I was already picking up the nautical terminology. We were separated by the colors of our badges. I learned for the first time that the light pink of mine meant environmental services, and was excited for a moment that they were going to make me a technician on the ship's desalinator, or its air filtration services, or some other part of the machinery that made life at sea possible. Not exactly. Environmental services is, it turns out, a New Age euphemism for being a janitor. A cleaning lady. A maid. Again. Janelle and I shared a knowing glance as our supervisor, Rory, a 24-year-old with a fresh crew cut and bad skin, explained that our critical duty aboard the ship was to empty garbage cans, maintain common areas, and launder the linens. We'd be working 12-hour shifts with 12 hours off every single day. They couldn't have explained this while we were still on shore. I probably would have still come, but waiting to spring this schedule on us when we were at sea, without land even in sight anymore, felt like an ambush. The weeks that followed were mostly a blur as I adjusted to life aboard a ship. My body acclimated to the 12-12 schedule faster than I'd like to admit. I got my first paycheck, and while it wasn't exactly Wall Street money, since I wasn't really spending anything aboard the ship, it was a good living. I weathered my first storm, gale winds gathering as my shift came to a close and battering the ship all through my 12 off, making the lights in the dining hall flicker and rocking me to sleep in my bunk. The most exciting part was the training to fight fires aboard the ship, being timed as I leapt into the clunky boots and heavy jacket and snagged the respirator over my face before spraying flames that jetted from a propane tank on the helipad. The lifeboats hung on racks high above the deck, pointed straight into the sea. They'd shown us a video, then walked all of us up the gangway to look into the lifeboat and pointed out all the controls for the engine and the steering, and shown us the big lever that you pull down on to drop the whole thing into the sea. Rory, wearing his other hat as emergency operations manager, complained that even in international waters, there were some burdensome regulations that just couldn't be escaped. The next day, I helped secure lines to the rails as a supply ship came alongside and watched a school of jellyfish float by between the two massive vessels. And I started to heal from my previous life. I felt like I was pushing out the jagged shards left in the frame after a window was broken. You have to do that before you put a new one in. A few days after we set sail, we crossed the magic line into international waters. I watched a team of men deploy a sea anchor meant to fix us in place in the middle of the ocean, and some of the computer engineers broke open a bottle of champagne into red plastic cups, announcing that their operation had begun. I was on duty, hauling a linen cart to the aft bunk rooms. No champagne for me. I watched the tugboats sail over the horizon, and for the first time, I felt trapped. Weeks blurred to months, and I had settled into this new life. I had begun reading, something I hadn't done much since high school. The ship had an extensive library, new editions of many of the classics, all similarly bound, and a couple of handsome leather chairs with a lamp and a table between them. I rarely saw any of the computer engineers in there, and definitely none of the security guards. I lost myself in Charlotte and Emily Brontë. I read Moby Dick and some Hemingway books. I discovered Deborah Magpie Erling and Elise Blackwell. The library became a personal haven for me, a private reprieve from Rory's ever-swinging moods. Janelle and I speculated that he thought environmental services manager meant what we thought it meant. And from the leering computer engineers who stared at my ass every time I went into the server rooms to clean out the garbage cans full of empty energy drink cans, candy bar wrappers, and microwaved food containers. One night, under a full moon, a garbage bag in each hand headed for the compactor, I caught one of the security guards with his pistol out, a silencer on the end, shooting at fish jumping in the sea. He caught me staring and looked at me like he had something to say, then went back to what he was doing like I wasn't even there. It was one thing to pick up crusty socks and stained underwear from a bunch of computer engineers who were living like teenagers in their first apartment, but this shit turned my stomach. Freedom is a fine idea, but to use it like this? The honeymoon phase had come to an end. The next morning, I started looking for other jobs. That afternoon, Rory took me aside, telling me he had heard I was looking for other employment. No, he hadn't. I hadn't said a word to anyone. They'd been spying on me on the internet. That was the last straw. I didn't tell him, but right then and there, I knew. As soon as my shore leave came up, I was never getting back on the Rourke. Turns out, that decision was made for me. A summer squall blew salt spray across the deck, rocking the entire ship. It was a moonless night, and the exterior lights did little to illuminate my way back to my shared cabin. I rounded the corner behind one of the cooling towers and came upon a figure in all black, with a black backpack, face covered with a mask except for the eyes, wide in astonishment, as I'm sure mine were. Behind him, I saw one of those inflatable rafts with a little outboard motor on it. One of the security guards was in a motionless heap by the deck rail, and, inexplicably, I was not sorry to see it. We looked at each other for a long moment. He nodded at me. I nodded to him, then kept on my way. Thinking about this moment later, I wonder how I knew that although he was dangerous, I was not in danger. Something in his eyes? I went through the bulkhead into my cabin, where Janelle was just getting dressed for her shift. "Hey, girl," she said, pulling her ID badge off the corner of her bed and placing it around her neck. I stood motionless in the doorway, no idea how to tell her what I'd seen. She looked up at me, then went still. "What's up?" I think somebody's going to sink the ship," I said, already feeling foolish. I had no way of proving that was their intention, but somehow I knew it, the way you know things in a dream, which is what this felt like. A strange dream you wake up and chuckle at yourself for and wonder how your mind comes up with nonsense like that. "What?" "Yeah, there's... I saw a man in a ski mask with a backpack. I think they're going to sink the ship," I repeated, a little more confident now, with some details behind my assertion. Janelle stared at me, agape, for a moment before coming back to herself. Did you tell anyone? I came straight back here. She thought about this for a moment. So did I. As one, we went out to the bulkhead, headed for the lifeboats. The two of us buckled in, each with a hand on the lever that would upend both our lives for the second time this year. Janelle and I shared a look. On the count of three, we pulled it. The little orange boat dropped onto the rails, then slid down them fast, the hull vibrating beneath our feet. We plunged into the water, and then, just as suddenly, we were back up, upside down, and the entire craft flipped over backwards before landing upright among the waves. Janelle's eyes were wide as coasters, and we laughed like schoolgirls, screaming out our frustrations and our exhilaration, and Rory and every cum-soaked sock and shit-stained pair of underwear we'd picked up in the last several weeks. We laughed until our ribs hurt and tears ran down our faces. The Rorik was a few hundred yards off our bow. The radio crackled. Rory, demanding we return immediately, cursing our names, asking, "Do you even know how much one of those lifeboats costs? Do you realize this is piracy?" Janelle reached over and turned the volume knob down until the receiver clicked off. I laughed. She looked at me and said, "He didn't want to listen to us. I don't want to listen to him." This sent me further into a fit of laughter, and as I doubled over, trying to catch my breath, flames sprouted from the deck of the Rorik, and a shockwave passed over us. Machinery twisted on its supports and tumbled into the sea, disappearing without fanfare beneath the waves. We sat in stunned silence, and I watched, mouth agape, as people jumped from the deck, some of them on fire, the ship already beginning to tilt to one side, and wondered what the dolphins would have to say about this.
And we're back. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. Could you introduce yourself with your name, pronouns, and just a little bit about yourself? What do you do in the world, whether it relates to writing the story or not?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm Bill Stickers. I use he, him pronouns, and I live in the mountains and work for a living and do a fair amount of mountain related activities, skiing, hiking, hunting, all that fun stuff. And read a lot and write a little less than that.
So even though we literally just finished listening to your story, could you kind of walk us through it again, from like the mouth of the author? What is the story about? And yeah, what do you think of it?
Totally. Yeah. So With the Dolphins is about, lady named Katrina Johnston, who feels kind of stuck in her life. You know, she has this job and this apartment and, you know, this kind of set way of living that she feels kind of trapped within. And she sees an opportunity to escape it by hitching her wagon to a different horse, so to speak, and gets involved with this company that is building an artificial general intelligence like in international waters. And she doesn't understand kind of what that means and all the implications of that, but she knows it's big and exciting and in the news. So she jumps on board and pretty quickly becomes disillusioned with the realities of it. And she sees an opportunity to leave, sees that something is about to befall the ship, so to speak, and she grabs the one friend she's made, and they make their exit.
What kind of what went into writing this story, or where were there any points of inspiration, or why this story? Why?
Totally.
Question mark.
Yeah. So I saw on Twitter, judge me not too harshly, but I saw on Twitter that this company, you know, this like NFT bro was talking about, you know, he designed this ship and he was like, well, if there's going to be all these burdensome regulations in the United States, because people were talking about that, then we're just going to put all these computers on a boat. And we're going to put it into international waters. And one way or another, we're going to build an artificial general intelligence. And that immediately sparked for me like this thought of how many, like, libertarians love international waters for some reason, right? Because, I mean, not only all these burdensome regulations about what they can and can't do with whatever project they're working on, but also because then they can, they're not really beholden to the labor laws of their home country or whatever. And all the other stuff. And it made me think of, you know, like Sealand and Rapture from BioShock. And I kind of, to be honest with you, last summer was really living for the billionaire submarine, the tragedy, if you want to call it that. But just like this idea of really wealthy people flaunting not only like regulations and best practices for safety, but also like common sense and people advising them not to do the things that they're doing. And I was like, I think this could be a really great story. And then I, in thinking of what sort of point of view I wanted to tell it from, I was really interested in not like the captain or the owner or anything like that, but that of like a working class person who maybe isn't really buying into all the AGI, NFT, Bitcoin, whatever, like kind of the all these false promises that we've been given from the tech industry in the last couple of years, but just kind of wants to do something big and different, and how they might get involved with something like that. And then what a like sensible working class person's impressions would be of a project like that from up close.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that's so funny. It's in the world of, you know, tech billionaires doing crazy things, I shouldn't be all that surprised, but I did not know that there is some like NFT bro who's trying to do the exact premise of the story, which like build like a artificial general intelligence on a giant boat in international waters. Wait, what?
Yeah. Yeah, it, you know, I don't know if they're even at the point where they're generating funding for it or whatever. I just saw this like proposal and this like CGI rendition of the barge that would have the massive computers on it. And I was like, that is so hideous and goofy. Yeah, I might be able to dig up that Twitter post, I think from like December or January, but I immediately latched onto that as a pipe dream and was like, what is it with these folks and wanting to just build new libertarian utopias out at sea?
Yeah, it's wild. And I don't know, it's like there's two wolves inside of me. One of them is like, please stop doing this shit. Like, it is, you are like the consequences of like billionaires' decisions on the rest of the world is like astronomical. And then there's the other part of me that's like, go down to the bottom of the ocean in a shitty little tin can, or Elon Musk, go to Mars, just do it. Just fucking go. Like,
yes. Yeah.
Then we will never have to deal with you again. Please go to Mars.
Yes, absolutely.
Please engage in high risk activity.
Yeah.
Please.
Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me too of when Jeff Bezos went to like launched himself into orbit with William Shatner. And I was watching that the whole time, like, come on. I know you cut costs. I know you cut corners. Come on, dude.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm like, if you're flaunting your wealth with your dream trip to space is going to get you killed, then sure. I don't care. Your decision.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, it was your idea. You're at the helm of this, like whatever misfortune befalls you as the billionaire financing these projects is kind of, you know, you went into it with both eyes open and these were all your decisions, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. To kind of delve back towards your story, though, so I had this very humorous comparison, which it's very interesting to see these things not from like you're not hearing the story from like the tech billionaire who's like on the ship helming the project. You're not even hearing it from like a revolution, the revolutionary or like whoever is like in that black ski mask at the end, you know? You're hearing it from like a random worker who has no stake in anything. And it's like the whole process of the main character being onboarded, like, and just everything that they're dealing with and like the reality of like, oh, this is weird, this is wacky. It reminded me of, have you ever watched Neon Genesis Evangelion?
Yes.
Yeah. It reminded me of like just the crazy gargantuan structures or like whatever that they build. And then like the reality that like thousands of people have to like just be a person at a computer board on
Yeah.
something like in this like weird floating ship that's like the thing that shoots the sword up into their hand, and their whole
Right.
job is being on the thing that shoots the sword up into their hand. That's their job.
Yeah.
And just and with like the artificial intelligence aspect too, I think I halfway expected at the beginning of the story for like to have some for this person to have some like wacky experiences with interacting with the AI or something, which I'm really glad it didn't go in that direction. But as they were like boarding the ship, I was like, is this gonna get more Evangelion-esque? Because that's like where it's leading to me right now. But
Totally. Yeah, I really love and have written a fair amount of like speculative fiction, so I really wanted to keep this story a lot more grounded. And so something that was kind of in the back of my mind like throughout the process of writing this was just like I work or I'm sorry, I live in the Rockies in a very tourist laden area, if you want to call it that, and just the difference between like the face that people in tourist facing positions put on versus like the stories they tell and like the kind of behind the scenes, the workers' perspective of things like guiding fly fishing or working at like these huge resorts that provide quote unquote authentic Western experiences. And what it's how the similarity, you know, I've worked a lot of different jobs, the similarity in the regard that workers have for their employers, and like they're like just that kind of bone deep pragmatism that you look at these things from like this perspective of what the day-to-day reality like looks, tastes, feels, sounds, and smells like, and how the romance of these things is depicted on like television, is often you talk to the people who actually do jobs like this, and the reality is often quite different.
It's like we're kind of fed these really like kind of catered experiences of what something is like. It's like especially through like adventure tourism or like even like the lens that media like focuses on with just a lot of professions in general. I don't know. It's like I haven't done too intense of like bouts in some of these jobs where you're kind of like all in, usually involves traveling, usually involves or like involves like living somewhere like on site for a really long time. But like one it's like one of the things that sticks out to me about that, which it's like I'm glad that in the story it's like the working conditions that you presented. I'm like, that's not even that crazy. That's like that's what a lot of people's jobs are. Like I work in like a stagehand industry, and like I see like a lot of like I just work with a local, but I see like a lot of these like Broadway shows come through, and there's these people who are like on the tour who are like the head carpenter or whatever, and it's like their whole life is like it's like 12 hours on, and then like realistically like 4 hours off or something, just like wacky. And
yeah,
it's like the level of commitment that, like, for these like large productions, whether it be a Broadway show or whether it be like an adventure tourism, like kind of like camp, or whether it be like a giant artificial intelligence floating in international waters. It's like, there's this, we've come to this point in society where like it is expected that thousands of workers like put their lives on hold so that these like mechanisms can continue to function. And it's like, totally. I don't know. I hate it. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. And I know you work in kind of like similar like job spheres.
For sure. And I do work long shifts and long hours, but like it's different. My specific industry is like kind of few disclaimers. And then my experience of that is that it's not what I, again, was thinking of kind of in writing this story, was that like, when we talk about, again, like Elon Musk is a great example of this. People are like, oh, well, he never sleeps and he's always working and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, yeah, he doesn't allow his engineers to sleep. Like he doesn't, I'm not much less interested in his commitment because he also has the major stake. And also this was all his idea and he stands to make money and like all of this, you know, FaceTime on the news from it. He has a lot to gain. Whereas his engineers, obviously have much less skin in the game, but they have these similar expectations of, you know, he calls them in the middle of the night. He works them for these long hours. You know, you read about like the work cultures at a lot of these tech companies where it's like, yeah, people are expected to like sleep in their offices and that's not viewed like you're weird if you don't do that. And that's just, and those people never on an individual level are valorized in the way that the billionaires forcing them to do those things are valorized. To imagine that, you know, nobody's as committed as, you know, Elon Musk or whatever is absurd, right? Like, especially in the case of my story specifically, where everybody is on a ship, everybody's on the same ship, you know? And it's, you know, I'm sure I didn't really go into like, you know, the officers' quarters and the officers' mess, like all those different strata, although I think they're natural to imagine. But at the end of the day, they're all contained within like the same hull. So even though certain people get much more of the valor and the glamour and what have you, everybody is equally committed.
Yeah. And it's like, that's our shifting work culture. It's like, what is it? Elon just like announced a pretty large layoff at Tesla. And it's like the same thing he did with Twitter, where he's like, yeah, we're getting rid of a lot of job redundancies. And, the people that are staying, we're asking to essentially work five times as hard. And it's like building in this cultural expectation which I feel like his whole goal is to breed fanaticism because he knows that works.
Yep. Yeah. And it's shockingly effective because you see just the strangest dweebs on the planet on social media going to bat for this guy. And it's like, he's never going to read this. Hitching your ego to his public image to what end? You know what I mean? The same way we're seeing people like defend the Cybertruck, which has been a disaster, or all these other projects. And it's like, you're getting nothing out of this. You're except for like the personal perception that you are within this sphere of people who are pushing the world forward to the complete detriment of your ability to see factually that you are not. Again, kind of tying back to the story, like Katrina, our protagonist, is completely untaken by the world of like the, for lack of a better word, like bullshit generated around AI and like its promise for the future. I really wanted to investigate or explore the kind of nuts and bolts reality of what that kind of thing looks like.
Yeah. It was also like interesting to me. It's like kind of at the beginning of the story, we have this person who, and I think this kind of speaks to how it's like the tech industry kind of like costumes itself as this like prestigious like enterprise, you know. But it's like we have this person who's like so fed up with her current life that she's like, yeah, I will drop everything and burn some bridges in like the pursuit of like getting like that this move might help me get out of this like kind of lifestyle. And it's, you know, it's an empty promise as the tech bubble kind of was for a lot of people. But
yeah.
I don't know. We spoke a little bit like off air before this, but I know this kind of has like a personal story kind of tie in for you.
Yeah, I really related to, you know, I used to live in the Midwest for a while and found myself in this position where I had this job that like paid pretty well, but you know, all my friends had moved away or were kind of going down paths that I couldn't follow. And I just remember this feeling of like, I'm trapped. You know what I mean? Like it's, and this is 11, 12 years ago. It's conditions aren't even as hard for people who work for a living as they are now. But it was like, well, I got to keep paying rent. And to do that, I got to keep working at this job that I don't really love. And my social life is shrinking. And my ability to sort of rhapsodize or fantasize about the future and like all the, you know, I could kind of feel the world of possibility like shrinking around me a little bit. And I felt this same impulse that this character does to kind of like completely detonate my life in order to escape that. It's like I moved out west with literally the contents of my life in my truck at the time, and very little money to my name. And I lived out here like my first week, off of a jar, like a Costco sized jar of peanut butter. And just was like, I'm going to sink or swim, you know, do or die, whatever. But like, I just don't want to feel trapped like this anymore. You know, it was a specific feeling that I just couldn't tolerate. And I'd been living in this sort of pattern for a while. So I kind of used that in order to explore again how somebody might enter an industry that again gets glamorized on television and, you know, in the news and social media, what have you, without both eyes open, but just out of a desire to escape this pattern of like comfortable misery. Yeah. So I used kind of my feelings from those experiences to sort of propel the characterization of here.
Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me of this, I guess, like interesting tie-in. I feel like I'm going to say a thing that is whatever. I don't think it's all that controversial.
Go for it.
It's this kind of repeated, it's this repeated mechanism in our society that like, that we have these, like it's like society creates these desperate situations for people and then offers these like really awful ways out. And it's like, but it's like the way out is like, it's not a way out. It's like being, society creates these like untenable living conditions so that we jump at the first chance to like get out of those situations. And it's like what we're jumping into is often like as worse as, or as bad as what we were or worse. And like, I don't know. It reminds me of westward expansion when like a lot of colonization was still like earlier days of colonization on Turtle Island. And like and it's like not to excuse people who were like very actively took part in that, but it's like, I don't know, like the way that banks and like development companies and like all this shit were like working, were like, it's like they set up these like famously called like starvation claims like in like where like Montana and South Dakota and like all these places, and we're like, it's like they needed people and bodies to do the work that they didn't want to do, which was, and they, it's like dangling this hope in front of people that like they can like get out of the current trap that they're in. But it's like what they needed was for people to go die and like continue the westward expansion. And that's what happened to a lot of these people who were like, one, tricked into like participating in this like fucking settler colonial like farce, and with like the promise of like what, like living on your own, the libertarian promise, you know. And then they like what they got was starving with their families in South Dakota.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, the mechanism has like changed between then and the modern era, but like the whole premise of being kind of sold a false bill of goods in order to be wrangled into doing work that you don't, you're going to find out you don't really want to do, is, I mean, pretty much it's the same story. You know what I mean? Like I think about people who I've met just out in the world who were in the, you know, the United States military, who were like literal children. I mean, 16, 17, and they, you know, were in the school to prison pipeline. You know, they were charged for, you know, charged with crimes. And then a judge told them, you can join the military or you can go to adult jail, and wound up doing things like that. Or, you know, as a way of escaping, you know, I wanted to escape, you know, the gang life or whatever it was. Or also, yeah, I had something else in mind. But anyway, yeah, just it's a very common thing in our system, in our society, going all the way back, as you were saying, to the, like the beginning, to Manifest Destiny, like just this common through line of we need bodies to do the hard work, the work that people with both eyes open would not want to do. So we're going to offer to people who, you know, feel trapped, this promise of something bigger and better, and then kind of pull the rug out from under them. I, you know, just again, kind of tying it back to the story, I'm thinking specifically of like Katrina and Janelle being told that they were going to work in environmental systems, and thinking, oh, I'll be, you know, like maintaining the desalinator and the, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then it turns out that it's just another custodial job. And I, in like that euphemism actually comes from a different job that I had, where the people who did that work, that was the name they were given, the EVST or whatever, environmental systems technician. But in the reality of it is much different. I always wondered, like, who came up with that term? You know what I mean? Did somebody ask like, hey, what would you get? What would y'all like your job title to be? Or did somebody in, you know, administration just decide, you know what sounds a lot better than housekeeping or janitorial, you know, whatever, environmental systems, that sounds a lot better. Yeah.
And it's like, I don't know, people like to paint up their, it's like the companies or whatever like to paint up things so that people like feel better, feel more invested. Or, and, but they like paint it up as like pride, or they paint it up as like, like taking pride in the work that you do or something. And it's like, and it, that gets people to invest. And it's like, it like invest in these futures that aren't theirs. And like, I don't know, it's weird, but it works. And like,
yeah,
but I feel like we are getting to a point more increasingly where people are becoming far more disillusioned with that stuff. And yes, it's like, it's not working. Like a lot of people are kind of like, wait, I'm sorry, you want me to do what for this like shitty job? Like, I feel like more and more and more, there is more widespread critique of this as well. Like, I don't know, like, for some reason, what's coming to mind is like a lot of the fast food restaurants in like Florida during like 2020, 2022, where people were like, we're quitting, you're not paying us enough. And they're like, but the place will go out of business. And they're like, don't fucking care, your problem. And they just like left, like keys in the door. They're like, not my problem.
Like, yep. Yeah, exactly. It's a bit like the managers love to use, like, I'm sure you've heard before that anytime a place of business says that its employees are a family, it's more like a cult. Managers love to use words like, or, you know, terminology like taking pride in your work. You know, we're all a family here, et cetera, to cynically elicit buy-in from the workers who actually generate the value that the business relies upon, while giving them nothing in return. And more people are seeing right through that scheme and saying, well, if we're a family, then why am I having trouble making rent? And why, you know, can't I take care of my actual family, you know, and why am I missing holidays and, you know, ball games and big events and birthdays and this, that, and the other for a company that just asked me to do, like we were saying earlier, five times as much work for no increase in pay. People are starting to really see through sort of the those cynical illusions that they're trying to press into people's heads. And I think it's for the better. I mean, you know, union people, there have been a lot of recent, very highly publicized union drives, which is super encouraging. And just in general, like speaking with people out in the working world about like, hey, I don't feel like it's not fair the way that we're being compensated for our work. And people are more receptive to that line of that topic of conversation than they used to be.
Or it's like, to kind of tie it into the end of the story, there's the also an increasing amount of more people like in the workplace who are like not going to make it their problem when something is going wrong, you know? Where they're like, it's like a great example being far more people who like work at like big box stores and stuff, like seeing like shoplifting and stuff and being like, that's not my problem.
Exactly. Like I, have no like, reason to put myself like, it's, it's not in my job description to put my safety at hazard or even to bother somebody. Cause you know, insurance will cover shoplifting, you know, they call it shrink or whatever. But the company doesn't lose money. I'm not going to lose my job over it. Like, let it go.
Yeah, which is like the cool thing that we see at the end of the story is like these two people who are like, you know, it's like I wouldn't say by any stretch that either of these characters, like we glean anything that they're like politically against what's happening. They're just like, I'm absolutely not going to die for this. And these people treat me like shit. So I could like really give a fuck about what happens. Like, I'm just going to like quietly get away. And like...
Wow. That looks like it sucks. I'm leaving.
What if I didn't die? And like, also that the, you know, the black ski mask, whatever, whoever's there, like also sees our protagonist and is like, you're not going to do it. You're not who I'm here for.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. There was shout out to a friend of mine, Amanda, who read it early on. And she was like, I'd really love it if there was like this moment of kind of recognition between Katrina and the unnamed person in the ski mask. Because they, even though they're, I mean, there's no conversation or whatever between the two of them, but there's this recognition of like, he's dangerous, but he's not dangerous to me, if that makes sense. Like, just like you said, like they're not here for me. They're against whatever it is that we're doing here. So I was pretty happy. Very, very thankful to her for suggesting that kind of moment to bring sense to the way that it ends. Because that was kind of, I mean, the ending that I always had in mind from the very moment I laid eyes on the like ugly CGI barge on the internet was like, oh, that thing has got to go to the bottom of the ocean.
I like too that it's like we have this story from the perspective of someone who's not involved in like the boat sinking, and so it's like it's like the story itself, like we're not like, we're, you know, I feel like most people aren't like, I'm sad the barge sank, or they're like the choices of the protagonist or whatever call into question. But it's like, you know, I did think about, I guess, God, I feel like it's called like the Death Star conundrum, with like a lot of, which gets brought up in all the like the like Clerks movies or whatever. Totally. Like, well, what about all of the workers that were on there? And it's like, we're seeing the story from the perspective of someone who's not involved in the destruction of the ship and is like saves the people that are immediately around her. And like,
totally.
I don't know. Sorry, not to at the end of the interview, just bring up the kind of the moral complexity to
totally
large scale industrial sabotage.
Yeah, but... for sure. Yeah, no, but that's, I didn't even think about the Death Star conundrum, but yeah, that makes sense too. Like I've heard that before, but yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. And yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Anyways, what else are you kind of working on in the world? Have you written other things? Where, what writing, how, why?
Yeah, so I've had a couple poems published in the local university press, and you know, written a number of other short stories that I've shopped around, and I'm currently working on project with a good friend of mine. We're actually going to get together tonight to work on it. Similar themes, but a very kind of different kind of story.
Cool. Yeah. Are there any other kind of like themes or whatever that you like to focus on with writing, or what is, yeah.
Quick. Yeah. In general,
on writing.
Yeah. Yeah. In general, I really enjoy, stories like this that like take the perspective of like one of many workers or just like working class people, and just kind of what coming to sort of the similar conclusions that I came to throughout my working life, which is kind of, as we've discussed throughout, like, yeah, this company doesn't care about me. Like I'm can't center my life around my work because the job does not love me back. And you know, as a person working in this world, I need to be thinking about like what I'm deriving from work and not just what work is taking from me. And I also really enjoy stories and writing stories about, you know, kind of the outlaws of the world, like the Nestor Makhno type figures and, you know, Joseph Stalin in his early years. And I just listened to the Cool People Who Did Cool Stuff about the expropriators. And just stories like that of like, if you want to like paint them with a broad brush, kind of your Robin Hood-esque stories of people taking from those who don't deserve it and giving it to those who that they feel that do. Yeah. So those are two kind of broad stories that I really like to explore in my work.
Cool. Look forward to reading more of it. Well, that kind of mostly brings us to the end of our time. Are there any things that you want to shout out in the world, whether those are projects you're part of or just projects that you want to draw attention to? And is there anywhere that people can find you on the internet where you would like to be found? Which, yeah, the answer can be no. Don't find me.
Yeah. I would say find your local... Food Not Bombs are equivalent. They do really important work that really means a lot to people, and just contribute in whatever way that you can. Even if that's just to like share their social media posts and like kind of get the word out there. I would also encourage everybody listening to this to find and take a Stop the Bleed class. Those skills are, it turns out, really important in the world that we live in right now, it's sad to say. I cannot really be found on the internet, but don't worry. That is perfectly okay with me. I try and keep a low profile.
Hell yeah. I kind of love it when people are like, no, don't find me here. You can find me here in this, and that's it.
Totally.
But also presumably more in the future, 'cause you're writing other stuff, but
yeah.
Anyways, now we just have this last little bit, which is the word of the month, which, you know, I always try to find a word that at least somewhat relates to, like the story or whatever that we're featuring. And I found something that was like a little indirect. Like the word that I chose, which relates to the story, is like not actually like I wasn't that interested in it, but it led me along like a nice little like breadcrumb trail to something that was really interesting to me. And so, yeah. Oh, we forgot to talk about this, kind of, but you know, we're going to talk about it now. Dolphins. What do you think about dolphins?
I love dolphins. I, as a kid, was really, you know, I talked about this a little bit in the story, but was really fascinated by like the Lisa Frank folders. And there was also this movie, Flipper, that had Elijah Wood and the dude from Crocodile Dundee. And I like, as a kid, like wore out the VHS of that. And I, yeah, just dolphins are really fascinating to me. Like they speak their own little language and they like form friendships and bonds and have all these really interesting behaviors. And yet, unlike, you know, when we think about creatures that are similar to humans, the first thing that comes to mind for people is like monkeys, which obviously live on land and like kind of look similar to people. But dolphins are like intelligent and like people have argued, I don't know that I would necessarily argue, but like sentient, in that they communicate and like cogitate and think and make decisions. But they're much more obscure to us, unless you go to like SeaWorld or something, you know, and you can see them in the tank, which I'm not a fan of, in principle, but, I don't know. They're just really fascinating creatures. And I, remember like, just like in going back to kind of childhood memories of dolphins, remember thinking about there's like the scene in Flipper where they like toss a whole fish to a dolphin and it like snaps it up. And I remember as a kid thinking like, oh man, eating a whole fish must feel so great if you're a dolphin, even though that's like something that's not appealing to me as a human, but like, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
I have a deep affection for dolphins, but I believe that they should be left where they belong, which is in the ocean with each other. You know, they should be this kind of like semi opaque mystery to us. I enjoy the, or I am fond of the kind of space that they occupy, where it's like maybe they're like sentient, maybe they have their own little dolphin society going on under the waves, but it's not for us.
Yeah. Any clue what the word dolphin means or like where the word comes from?
None at all.
I like kind of guessing to myself before I look things up. And I will say that I was somewhat correct about this, which was fun. Not about what the word means, but kind of some other connections to the word. So dolphin like ultimately comes from a Greek word, delphis, which means womb. Or which, you know, people attribute to like, because it is a strange, a creature unexpectedly with a womb, or, you know, like aquatic mammal.
Interesting.
Yeah. But it also relates to, there, have you ever heard of like, the place in Greece called Delphi?
Yes, I've actually been there.
Oh, interesting. Cool. And so like the oracle at Delphi, there's like it's like this place of like where this oracle lived who would speak to the gods and communicate prophecy and stuff like that. And so Delphi is named for dolphins, because like Apollo like supposedly like turned into a dolphin to like show people where it was. But Delphi had another name before Delphi, and this is what I found much more interesting than the word dolphin. But it used to be called Pythia, which was like named for this person that lived there, named Pythia, which is also like the title for like the priestess at Delphi, like the high priestess. So like the oracle herself would have been called Pythia. And the name Pythia comes from the verb Puthian, which means to rot.
Huh.
And so like the priestess at Delphi, whose name is Pythia, and the city itself would have been called a place of rot, or like a priestess of rot. And
Interesting.
That is really interesting to me. But kind of like etymologic, or not etymologically, like but like the kind of origin of why is supposedly there was this giant python there, and Apollo killed it, and the body was like rotting around the city for a long time, which is why they call it, supposedly why they called it Pythia. But
wow,
I don't know. What's interesting to me is that like it's like Pythia and these people lived here before Apollo was like sent people there to seek an oracle. And snakes, as we know from like a lot of mythology, are often not monsters. They are in fact like creatures of truth and wisdom. And so that is what I like to imagine more of for Pythia. This is not based on real etymological or archaeological work. This is purely my own hopes and dreams for what totally. This meant. But it's my hope that like, you know, these were like people who were like, yes, we worship the rot. We speak to the rot. We like the rot is good and we speak to it, which is entirely unrelated to my love of this thing that we created in Penumbra City for like the weird fungal entity that lives under the city. But
oh, that
anyways,
is so
that's
cool.
My obscure word of the month, which is not actually the word of the month. It's any thoughts?
No, I think that is really fat. I need to like brush up on my Greek mythological knowledge because I had no idea about that when I went there. That is really, really cool. Pure speculation. So at the time when I went there, which was like a little over a decade ago, the prevailing, or at least the popular, anthropological theory for like what kind of induced, I'm not going to say induced, but like what was the sort of magic behind, the oracles of Delphi or Pythia, seeing things, was that there was like a geothermal gas vent, that caused these hallucinations, right? And I, again, pure speculation, I wonder if that's not somehow related to, just as a person who lives where there's a fair amount of geothermal activity, if that's not somehow related to like the smell of like sulfur and rot, if that isn't also maybe part of where that comes from. But again, that's pure speculation. Yeah. But that is, I just learned like six cool new things in like a couple minutes. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I feel like I'm remembering this now, and it is, I think, probably apocryphal, but I mean, all of these things are apocryphal because who, like, you know, who knows? I think I've also heard stories that Pythia was trans. And
awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And this like role that like it like connects to the role that trans people played in a lot of like Mediterranean cultures as being like weirdly much more revered than feared,
totally,
as in a lot of our current societies, but having a special connection with the otherworldly.
That is fascinating.
Yeah, and you know, half remembering this, don't remember where I heard it, apocryphal at best, but fun to think about.
Yeah. Headcanon,
at least.
I love it.
Great. Which is, I guess, maybe a funny note. So I do these words of the month, and like, they're like, I do real research into like learning about these words and the etymologies and stuff, and like there's a lot of folk etymology, there's a lot of apocryphal renderings of things, and a lot of this is my own speculation. I'm saying this as like a wider note on if anyone's ever looked up the things that I tell you about these words and been like, where's Inman getting this? It's not the most tightest of academic research, so.
Totally. Yeah. But it's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, abandon billionaires to their inevitable fates. We don't have to tell you how. And also, if you liked it, you can tell people about the show. You can rate and review and like and subscribe or whatever the algorithm calls for. Feed it like a hungry god. However, if you want to support us in other sillier ways that don't involve feeding a nameless and mysterious entity, consider supporting the show financially by subscribing to our Patreon. If you subscribe to our Patreon at $10 a month, we will mail to you a zine version of the pieces that you hear here every month, anywhere in the world. You can also get access to an archive of Old Strangers content, as well as discounts on things like t-shirts and books we publish. Also, a little known thing is that for our like $5 a month tier, you just get all of our stuff that we release in digital form, always. So anything that we put out, you can get it for $5. You can also find other podcasts we put out, like The Spectacle, the podcast for people that love movies and hate cops. But before we go, we would like to shout out some of our patrons as part of our Patreon acknowledgement tier. If you would like us to thank you, someone you love, a rad organization, or a theoretical and fictional concept, then subscribe to our Patreon for $20 a month, and I will thank whatever you ask me to. Unless it's like the Empire. I'm not thanking the Empire. Thank you, Alium, Amber, Ephemeral, Appalachian Liberation Library, Portland's Hedron Hackerspace, Boldfield, E. Patoli, Eric, Buck, Julia, Catgut, Marm, Carson, Lord Harkin, Trickster, Princess Miranda, Ben Ben, Anonymous, Funder, Janice and Odell, Allie, Paparuna, Milica, Boise Mutual Aid, Theo, Hunter, SJ, Paige, Nicole, David, Dana, Chelsea, Starro, Jennifer, Kirk, Chris, Micaiah, and Haas the Dog. Thanks so much for all your support. It means so much to us and has allowed us to get so much done as a collective. And lastly, a lot of these features on the podcast come from listeners like you. So if you feel like a stranger that would like to find their story a home in this tangled wilderness, consider submitting it, and maybe it will be some billionaire's downfall. Next month, we have a piece of nonfiction about May Day, because it's May. And that'll be with Margaret Killjoy, and it's going to come out on May Day, when we'll be switching over to having our features come out at the beginning instead of the end of the month. So check it out. We hope you come back.